In this edition of the podcast, my guest is Stephen Smith, Stephen B. Smith, who is a distinguished professor of political science at Yale University and is an expert on many things, including the works and ways and influence of Leo Strauss. He is, in fact, the author of an important book of just a few years ago titled Reading Leo Strauss. I was about to say good morning, Stephen. It's morning, but it's getting towards noon where you are.
Yeah, it's still morning.
At your office at Yale. Tolerate me for just a moment if I get a little bit windy in an extended introduction. The basic issue that we're dealing with is the relation between philosophy and politics. Mm-hmm. And particularly as that relates to Leo Strauss. Mm-hmm. Would you agree with the following, that in world political history, we have some philosophers who seem to have seriously altered the course of politics, indeed the course of nations? You could argue Voltaire and Rousseau helped to generate mm-hmm. the French Revolution. You could argue that Locke and Adam Smith had considerable influence upon our founding fathers
right.
and surely the shaping of the Constitution. You could argue that Nietzsche and Pareto and yet others who could be named helped to foster fascism. Would one similarly argue that Leo Strauss is the father of and fostered and is the sine qua non of what in this country we call neoconservatism, particularly as it has affected the shaping of foreign policy?
Well, I'm glad, Milt. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you today, and thank you for that lovely introduction. Well, you get right to the issue about Strauss, about his influence or alleged influence on world politics, and particularly on neoconservatism. I actually do not see Strauss as a political figure or an political influence of quite the same stature and quite the same importance as the figures you mentioned earlier, Rousseau, Nietzsche. Could mention Marx, obviously, as influence on communism.
I should have mentioned Marx, in fact, since he's the clearest example of a man who
sure.
sort of considered himself a philosopher
no.
altering the course of history.
Yeah. I'm not sure Strauss had those kinds of what I think of as epic ambitions, in part because I think Strauss was more, in many ways, more purely a philosopher and more purely what we might call today even a historian of philosophy. That's always what he called himself. I'm not sure he was a man who aspired to have this kind of, call it world historical influence. And yet, his writings have in many ways seeped into the public discourse, and they have had, I would say, a kind of indirect influence, not through so much through his teaching, but through the teachings of his students and students
yes.
of his students. It's kind of trickled,
you know, that
kind of trickled down a bit to about two generations later, where it seems to have this kind of influence on neoconservatives who are probably the most prominent sort of, in some sense, I would say, kind of distant relatives of Strauss. Not the only relatives, relatives to be sure, but somewhat distant relatives. Let me just leave it at that for now.
Yes, well, I see an interesting parallel that just came to mind. You mentioned Marx, mm-hmm. and of course I should have the first comment. Marx famously said in one of the meetings of the Communist International, "Je ne suis pas Marxiste."
Right.
Mm-hmm. I'm not a Marxist. But lots of other people have claimed
yeah.
that they are Marxists and offered that as a credential. Some still do to this day, despite the disabusing that we've had regarding Marxism and states built upon Marxism. Similarly, Strauss would probably have said, "I am not a Straussian," but there are many others who do identify themselves as Straussians.
Right.
In a recent article that you did was titled "The Strauss Wars."
Mm-hmm.
You talk about the Eastern versus the Western
right.
Straussians. The main Straussian on the West seems to be Harry Jaffa. Mm-hmm. On the East, we have, I think, my former colleague here at the University of Chicago, Bloom,
mm-hmm.
and also such people as Francis Fukuyama, the famous End of History
mm-hmm.
volume, Pearl, Wolfowitz, even Bill Kristol. they are all more or less self-identified Straussians. Mm-hmm. What do they mean when they say, I am a Straussian?
Yeah, good. Well, I mean, in many ways, the Strauss school has splintered very considerably in much the way that schools of disciples of all great philosophers have done. Rousseau's disciples seem to have split in many ways over the French Revolution. Of course, Marx's disciples most famously split between kind of hardcore Leninists on one side and sort of softer social democrats on the other. And I think what we're seeing is a similar kind of split within the disciples of Strauss. And it's not just my article that you referred to was really a review in last Sunday's New York Times Book Review section, really focused on what has become called the East and the West Coast wings. The West Coasters, like you say, are associated with Harry Jaffa and have emphasized the centrality of natural law to the American, particularly to the American experience, that the American regime is a regime focused on certain fundamental principles of, and unchanging principles of natural law that they believe shape or should continue to shape our jurisprudence, our public policy, our political debates, and that they fear have been lost by.
If I remember correctly, yeah. Jaffa particularly draws that meaning from the Lincoln Douglas debates.
Absolutely,
in a famous book that he did.
Yeah, that's true, but also claiming that Lincoln was doing no more than drawing on the works of Jefferson and Jefferson yeah. going back to Locke, and et cetera. The East Coasters and the others are somewhat, I think of it as a somewhat of a more diverse kind of disposition. I would call it a kind of disposition or temperament. I think its concerns are less with politics, more with questions of philosophy and the history of philosophy, questions of that I think animated a lot of Strauss's work, which were not of a directly political character, questions about what is the best way of life, how should one live, to what degree does philosophy inform or should inform a person's life, the kind of Socratic model here being for Strauss central. And it's and in many ways there are many shades and differences over this. You mentioned kind of public figures like Bill Kristol from the Weekly Standard, Paul Wolfowitz, former ambassador and high official in the previous administration. They were I don't want to say anybody, I'm not holding up a litmus test who's a Straussian, who's not. If you want to claim Strauss, claim Strauss. If you don't, don't. I think of them as, in many ways, more public figures who are sort of indirectly related to Strauss, or Straussianism through education, through background.
They may not claim Strauss as an influence. However, there are critics from the left looking at the neoconservatives, especially as regards the Iraq War, which became the great central issue. There are critics from the left call them Straussians and say Strauss is the father of neoconservatism, and neoconservatism is a kind of realpolitik pattern of action in the larger world to pursue national advantage. So that's the critique with which the Straussians have had to deal.
You put your finger on the issue when you say it's always the critics who label them as Straussians.
Yeah.
I'm not aware, for example, and I know each of the two figures you mentioned a bit, that either of them goes out and trumpets their Straussian credentials. I don't think so. It is usually a term that's applied by critics, and that's what makes it so inaccurate, or at least kind of impossible to attribute any content to. What did it mean? It has become, at least for the many on the left, just kind of an all-purpose term of abuse for those who hold often usually conservative politics or policies, especially in terms of foreign policy, that they disapprove of. Well, Straussian. Well, what does that mean? Show me where. Show me, please, where Strauss ever said any of these things or held any of the views that could be. I think it could be simply attributed to neoconservatism and the like. I think this is just absurd.
There is another facet of Straussian theory as perceived and interpreted by those who are critical of it, and those generally on the left who are critical of the neoconservatives, and that is that Strauss, in fact, borrowed some important ideas from Plato mm-hmm. and yet others to the effect that you cannot speak honestly and fully and openly mm-hmm. about what you want. The real business is not to create a republic mm-hmm. that has a democratic foundation. Right. To the contrary, the real business of the elite, of the philosopher mm-hmm. kings, is to use certain noble lies, Strauss's term in some context, to use noble lies, noble deceptions to convey reassuring and consoling images of what government is about and what the elite are undertaking, when in fact they're undertaking something else. The noble, and an ultimate example of the use of noble lies, say some of the critics from the left, was the doctrine of, or rather the assertion, that Iraq and Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and had intentions against much of the rest of the Middle East and surely Israel. Therefore, they had to be put down. Those noble lies were undertaken in a Straussian fashion. Particularly, it is said, what's the name of that woman up in Canada who's written all of this? It is said particularly about Wolfowitz and also about the Weekly Standard.
Well, couple of things about this. First of all, do you think the members of the last administration, or for that matter, any political administration that has ever existed in history, do you think they had to read the works of Leo Strauss to realize that politicians lie in public life? I mean, this is shocking. You know, no one ever thought of this before Strauss's famous teaching about noble lies or exoteric speech and the like. I mean, please. I mean, this is absurd. The idea that somehow nobody thought of this before Strauss, or Strauss gives this some kind of go ahead. And anyway, by the way, I would ask, somewhat rhetorically, I suppose, but what was so noble about the lie going into Iraq? I don't see anything particularly noble about this. What Strauss emphasized was that political philosophers teach, and I think this is something that common sense would tell all of us, that political leaders and political philosophers use a certain kind of consoling rhetoric, a kind of rhetoric to depending upon the audience to which they're speaking. You speak to a seminar class very differently than you would speak to a public meeting. That philosophers have to know how to tailor their argument, largely for pedagogic purposes, to their audiences, if their views are to have maximum influence. Everybody knows this who's ever taught before in a classroom. You have to know your audience. You adopt a style of speech, and that's part of what Strauss meant when he talked about distinguishing exoteric and esoteric language between public language and language that is kind of for those on the inside. I don't find anything sinister. I don't think there's anything sinister about this. In fact, most, I think, common sense interpreters of philosophical texts, as well as more as public discourse, understand that you always have to ask of a text or a writing or a speech, who is it addressed to? Why is the author or the speaker using the kind of language they are? And I think Strauss drew our attention to this kind of different ways of speaking, different styles of rhetoric, as opposed to just the kind of flat-footed interpretation of writings that people just, kind of simply and always say just whatever happens to be on their mind.
Clearly, yeah. We can agree that certain philosophers had tremendous influence upon political process, indeed turned history in some new directions or helped to do so. That's clearly true of mm-hmm. Voltaire, I would think, and of Locke, and quite likely mm-hmm. of Nietzsche, to whom Strauss had a kind of an yeah. ambivalent connection. But a basic question does arise. Can philosophers these days exert that sort of influence? It is asserted that Strauss had some such influence. That's what we're talking about. I have not heard in modern political analysis anybody contend that any other more or less living or recently living philosopher has influenced the ideology of great nations or the ideology of great socio-political movements. Is it possible that if philosophy once exerted such influence, it simply no longer does? Maybe because of changes in philosophy, maybe and its nature, maybe because of changes in the levels of literacy of politicians.
Now, that's a really, I think, profound question. First, I would say, as I kind of said at the beginning, I'm not sure I subscribe to the view that Strauss's views were sort of world changing in that way. But I think the changes of modern technology, the internet, other kinds of things do make it more difficult for people any longer, philosophers at least, to sort of set a sort of public discourse. Think, for example, of the tremendous influence of, say, someone like Jean-Paul Sartre in France in the years after World War II and the 50s and the 60s. But I think there are still figures in Europe and America who have something of that flavor to it. I think, for example, in Germany, a figure like Jürgen Habermas, I don't think he has the depth of Strauss, but he is very much a philosopher who is engaged with public issues in Germany and in Europe over the EU and a whole range of things, which have really, I think, in many ways set the terms of a lot of the debates about contemporary Europe in today. That would be one example. To take another slightly different example, closer to home, although this is not a philosopher who sought, I think, a kind of public role. But if you think, for example, again, in a different way, of the influence of, say, John Rawls, a name who's probably not familiar necessarily to the larger public, but who has had a tremendous influence in law schools and in the way in which I would say kind of liberal circles themes about justice and rights and so on are discussed.
And does that influence reach into the corridors of government, so to speak?
I think indirectly it does through judicial appointments and things like this. Often, of course, in America, as Tocqueville famously said, all issues eventually become constitutional issues. So I find the influence in this area largely coming through law, through judicial appointments, through the legal academy. Kind of trickles down through the legal academy. Although Rawls was not in a law school; he was in a philosophy department. But many of his kind of contemporaries and those with whom Dworkin and others were legal philosophers.
So much of modern philosophy has turned in a very different direction, asking these basic questions about the nature of society and the nature of the social good, but rather the nature of speech, the nature of thought. The Cambridge school of philosophers are essentially a branch of linguistic science or linguistic speculation. And that holds in many departments of philosophy. I don't think the basic issues that arise in traditional political philosophy from Plato forward are much examined or much elaborated, say, even in the philosophy department in which Leo Strauss once taught here at the University of Chicago.
Well, I think that's right. A lot of what we call philosophy today has I would say abnegated its public role, you know, for better or worse. A lot of the times you don't want philosophers so much engaged in public life. But one of the things that Strauss did, and to me, in my reading of Strauss and in my writing, in my different writings, has been very influential. Unlike so much of contemporary philosophy, Strauss did return to this older, much older conception of the of philosophy as a way of life, as a certain practice of life that he saw, I think, most fully expressed in the life of Socrates. I think that made a powerful influence on Strauss. And he always saw philosophy as fundamentally a question about how we live our lives. It was in many ways a deeply personal question, how to live. And for that reason, I'm partly critical of the view that sees Strauss as this kind of big political figure, because I think he was truly interested in the way in which individuals can live their lives more thoughtfully, more philosophically. And it's that kind of question that so much of modern philosophy has, in a sense, turned its back on, as philosophy has tried to emulate science, physics, increasingly today kind of neuroscience, and so on. It's really kind of lost touch with the moral questions, what Strauss always thought of as the fundamental questions about how we live.
You know, I must tell you, I met Strauss once or twice only to shake hands, you know, at somebody's party or other, a reception. I came to the University of Chicago while he was still teaching, though shortly thereafter he left his post. And when did he expire? In 1973.
He had left Chicago several years
I know,
before,
yes.
Yeah.
But I arrived in 65 and did meet him once or twice. However, I wonder how he would have responded to a work by one of his devoted students, a work which in some ways introduced the image of Leo Strauss to all of the country, indeed to all of the world. I have in mind, of course, Alan Bloom's The Closing of the American Mind.
Right, that would be fascinating. How would Strauss have thought of it? In many words, in obvious respects, the book draws deeply, deeply upon Strauss's understanding of the history of philosophy, the dangers posed by what Bloom and Strauss both thought of as modern relativism that has become, in fact, a kind of nihilism. What made Bloom's book, in a way, interesting, most interesting, I think, were the parts of it that were less indebted specifically to Strauss, but more his sort of analysis of contemporary American life, his reflections on music, on the family, on relationships, as he called them, his kind of emergence as a cultural critic of
well, it was
of
a kind of a Jeremiad. It was a sort of a Jeremiad against the works and ways of American popular culture as absorbed by college students.
Yeah, very very much so. And you know something, it was not a book that originally was it. Today, of course, we think of Bloom's book as sort of the kind of beginning of the kind of counter-revolution of the culture wars. But in fact, when the book first came out, it was warmly endorsed by critics, reviewers in the New York Times and the Washington Post and other, you know, kind of organs of liberal opinion. In fact, if I can just give you, I think, a kind of funny story.
Please.
Just before the book came out, I was fairly new at Yale at the time. It was probably about 87, 86. I can't remember now exactly. But it was shortly before the book came out. Bloom, who I had known from Chicago, was invited to come and give a talk here at the law school. And I was a young assistant professor at the time. I was invited because people knew I had come from Chicago. I was invited to come to this. And Bloom had sent, I think, page proofs of some of those early chapters on music and other things. And I remember at the time, I remember a prominent liberal liberal lawyer in the law school saying, and I think I quote from accurately from memory, he said, "When it comes to this, we're all Straussians." When it comes to music, we're all Straussians. It was kind of an interesting, I thought. And shortly later, of course, a liberal opinion turned against the book. But it's interesting that people's first responses are often the most kind of revealing and honest ones, that there was a lot of appreciation of it initially, at least.
Well, of course, Alan Bloom was stunned by the success of the book.
Absolutely.
And indeed also delighted by the millions of dollars that it brought into his coffers.
Well, who wouldn't?
Yes. Let's go back to Strauss, quite apart from the question of what influence he may have had on politics, but to the man himself. He was, of course, a German Jew. His year of birth, I believe, is 1899. Is that right?
That's correct.
And he doesn't get to this country until, well, what year exactly?
He doesn't actually get to this country until 1938, I believe. Yeah. He lived in England for about 5 years. He left Germany in 1932. He actually left the year before Hitler Rook came to power.
Uh-huh.
But then spent a few years in England where he was on a fellowship and working on a couple of different books. Did not actually emigrate to the U.S. till 1938.
And winds up at the New School for Social Research for about 10 years, and
exactly.
Then to the University of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
But his early work is essentially as a scholar of Judaism, or at least of Jewish thought, isn't
mm-hmm.
it?
Right. His earliest work, and it was something that he retained a powerful hold on him, was Jewish thought. Strauss in the 20s, I mean, still a very young man in his 20s, was part of the debates over political Zionism in Germany. He contributed to debates over the fate of the situation of German Jews. His first book, published in 1930, still in Germany, was a book on Spinoza's critique of religion. And most of his early work was really focused on what he himself later called the Jewish question.
Das Judenfrage.
Der Judenfrage, exactly.
Der Judenfrage, which the Nazis constantly spoke of. So
right.
They had a solution. They had a solution to the Jewish question.
They did. Yes, they did.
But he writes on other other important Jewish thinkers, doesn't he?
Oh, absolutely, as well as Spinoza. Of course, his the Jewish thinker that occupied the most number of pages in his life's work was Maimonides. Maimonides was a central figure for Strauss because Maimonides was a person who stood at the cusp of both the theological as well as the philosophical traditions.
And interestingly, the main title for Maimonides is The Guide for the Perplexed.
Exactly.
Is Strauss trying to de-perplexify our modern political life?
In fact, I would argue almost the opposite. I think he makes it more complex.
Yes.
One of the things that Strauss did, which I think won him many friends, but also equally won him many enemies, is he complexified things that had previously thought to have been clear and well understood and largely kind of now beyond much interesting discussion. Maimonides' Guide of the Perplexed being one of them. Strauss took his kind of laser-like mind as well as sort of the disposition of a literary scholar, focused on these texts and often showed them to be much more complex than people had thought, bringing out internal tensions, difficulties, contradictions, and really focusing on with a kind of, like I say, real laser beam on these difficulties. And, you know, that's something that it really shakes people up. I mean, when you think you know what Maimonides meant or what Spinoza meant or what Locke meant, the first encounter with Strauss is often to shake us out of these out of these complacencies, and frankly, a lot of people don't like that. It's a painful experience.
And reading Strauss, sometimes one does a double or even a triple take. For example, here's a direct quotation, just a few words. he called Heidegger the only great thinker of our time.
Right.
Heidegger the Nazi.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what in the world did he mean by that?
You had mentioned earlier that he had with regard to Nietzsche, had a kind of complicated kind of relation or, you know, appreciation of Nietzsche. And I think that was that statement of Strauss's that I quoted in my book about Heidegger being the only great thinker of the 20th century. Strauss was, just to give a little bit of context to this, Strauss in the 1920s had gone with a number of, he was part of an extraordinary circle of young German scholars who first encountered Heidegger at Freiburg University in the south of Germany. Sort of, this was even before Heidegger was such a famous name. He was still, at that point, not a particularly well-known figure. And Strauss was blown away by him. He really was. He talked about this in a number of essays.
So was Herbert Marcuse, and so was Hannah Arendt.
And Hans-Georg Gadamer, any number of extraordinary figures of that generation. And Strauss, one of the things that Strauss refused to do, however, unlike, say, Arendt, was to paper over the truly horrific side of Heidegger's writings. The fact that Heidegger's Nazism was not something that Strauss tried to hide or he didn't try to apologize for. He put it front and center and showed to some degree that Heidegger, who stood in Strauss's mind at the kind of pinnacle of modern philosophy, could also, that his philosophy led him to endorse Hitler's revolution in 1933. And that was for Strauss the great perplexity and the great problem of Heidegger that he always made clear. A great philosopher, yes, but a philosopher whose thinking led in the most horrific direction. That wasn't just an idiosyncrasy of Heidegger's. That political turn was deeply rooted in Strauss's view with the kind of historicism that Heidegger had embraced.
Well, what then the actual continuity between Heidegger's thought and Strauss's thought?
Well, I would put it this way. I'm not sure I would say continuity is quite the right word for it, but I think Heidegger remained a kind of conversation partner for Strauss throughout his writings. Heidegger was the man to whom Strauss felt it absolutely important to respond, and particularly because his philosophy had led, as you pointed out, to such dreadful consequences, political consequences and social consequences. It was important to sort of refute Heidegger. And I think a tremendous amount of Strauss's writing is really implicitly, he doesn't often mention Heidegger. In fact, he rarely mentions Heidegger by name. But once you're sort of attuned to this, you see that Strauss's work is an ongoing engagement with, and in many ways an attempt to move beyond and to be where Heidegger had left things. To take just a tiny example, if I can, probably Strauss's most famous book is a book called Natural Right and History.
Mm-hmm.
That book is clearly, the very title of it seems to be a response to Heidegger's book called Being and Time, Natural Right and History, Being and Time. There's a clear parallelism in the titles.
And would I be right in saying about this that what we have here, to oversimplify certainly, is that Heidegger, in a way, is a source of modern relativism, whereas Strauss is asserting a kind of absolutism, is asserting the absolute inerrancy and universal applicability, particularly of the value and the standard of justice.
There's definitely something to that. Strauss really, I think that the thing that most animates Strauss's work is an attack upon what he called historicism. It's a little bit of a clumsy term, but what we think of as relativism and that goes with it. Strauss's views, whether Strauss countered this with some kind of natural law absolutism, is a controversial claim. My view, and this is one that I addressed in my book on Strauss, I think Strauss fundamentally remained a skeptic. He said that. He even said that in his book on tyranny. My philosophy is skeptic in the original sense of the term. Skepticism, he understood, was something different than relativism. Relativism is itself, oddly, as he kind of counterintuitively, but relativism is itself a dogmatism. It dogmatically believes that all thought is relative, but of course it makes an exception for itself. The thought that all thought is relative is itself taken to be an absolute
yes.
truth.
All thought is relative except this thought that I'm now
the theory of relativity. Strauss thought of historicism and relativism as simply a new form of absolutism and dogmatism, to which he countered with his own skeptical philosophy. And what I mean by skeptical philosophy is, for Strauss, I think philosophical problems, philosophical arguments were all, at their core, essentially contestable. Great philosophers are engaged in a conversation. They're engaged in dialogue with one another. And Strauss always asked the question, who is right? You know, who got it right? Is it Plato? Is it Aristotle? Is it Maimonides? Is it Rousseau? Et cetera, et cetera. But Strauss understands no one ever quite gets it right. The nature of philosophy is to be questioning, it's to be skeptical, it's to be open-minded. And I think that's what Bloom was getting at when he talks about the closing of the American mind. We're closed to the kind of questioning that philosophy is really fundamentally about.
Leftist critics say that Strauss and Straussianism are the key to neoconservatism.
Mm-hmm.
To be sure, neoconservatives and other conservatives don't necessarily say that.
Right.
Many of the modern political philosophers, particularly the American ones you've named, like Rawls and so on, are essentially philosophers more easily claimed by American liberals
mm-hmm.
than by American conservatives.
Yeah.
A crucial question. Who really fills the role that some have attributed to Strauss these days? Who is a working, serious philosopher who in essence girds up or otherwise sustains the conservative temper?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are plenty of, conservatives around, thoughtful, intelligent conservative writers and people. They argue among themselves. I don't think anyone comes close to the depth, the profundity of Strauss. So even to name people is to be slightly embarrassing almost to put them in the same company. But I mean, there are many conservative writers who one can certainly learn from and appreciate.
I'm talking about philosophers,
philosophically minded writers. You know, I learn a lot every time I read David Brooks. I mean, David
uh-huh.
Brooks is a wonderful example of a University of Chicago graduate, by the way, kind of conservative who's learned a lot from the tradition, but is kind of applying it to contemporary events. I don't think David would call himself a philosopher, but certainly he's someone who's philosophically informed and draws on contemporary ideas. That would certainly be one example. The writers for journals like the Weekly Standard and National Review, but these aren't philosophers. I mean, they're smart people. Some of them focused on issues of public policy and current debates. I'm not sure there is anybody, frankly, who's filling the shoes that Strauss vacated. But let me just add, those are very, very large shoes. Strauss once said about philosophy, you would be lucky if once in a generation, maybe once in a lifetime, that you would encounter a real philosopher. Not just somebody who's in a philosophy department, but a real philosopher.
Yes.
And I'm not sure there is anybody who kind of fills the gap in that way left by Strauss. As soon as we finish, I'll probably think of names. But
do you aspire to to, if not fill that gap, at least address that gap?
I like to think of myself as addressing issues and addressing the issues that Strauss has deeply informed my thinking and my teaching. In fact, I'm teaching a course this semester in about an hour. I'm going to start in which we will talk about Strauss as a piece of the course. But it would be absurd for me to say that my work is on the same page with Strauss's. Of course not.
But surely you have helped to make him all the more accessible to ordinary readers.
Well, I hope I've done that.
Philosophical competence.
Exactly. I hope I've done that, and I have a little bit of evidence that I've tried to make Strauss, whose writings are difficult. They're not the kind of writings that because he came out of a German philosophical and to some degree philological tradition, and it's not something that most American scholars or even contemporary scholars we just don't have any longer. I mean, we didn't go to it. None of us went to a pre-World War I German gymnasium in the way Strauss did. We just don't have that kind of classical education any longer. Mm-hmm. The things that Strauss took for granted as part of the kind of palette of an educated person, of a scholar. But we just don't have that. So the rest of us just, you might say, do what we can.
And you've done what you can wonderfully well in two major works about Strauss, which are by no means the only works on your list. But reading Leo Strauss and the Cambridge Companion to Leo Strauss. And you've done a great deal for us in this discourse this very day. So I know that you're getting ready a little bit later to go off to a ball game, isn't that right?
I'm going to see the Yankees and the Orioles tonight, right.
You're a famous Yankee fan, I've heard.
I am indeed, yeah. I don't know how famous I am, but as a fan, because unlike the Straussians, there's a much larger family of Yankees fans than there are of Straussians.
Sure.
I'm part of that empire, right.
But before that, you're off to do a class on Strauss.
I'm teaching a class this semester on the three figures who I think are the greatest 20th century political thinkers, and those are Isaiah Berlin, Michael Oakeshott, and Leo Strauss. And the course is
how
on these three figures. Yeah.
How interesting. I have heard in my youth. I heard Oakeshott at LSE, as a matter of fact.
A wonderful writer, and a beautiful man.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you again.